Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. It's good to see you and to be here at OC Talk Radio Studio. I always enjoy this. And today is going to be an interesting show. We're going to talk about a subject that's very important to me, and that we dealt with it a bit in our first half, second half life series, but we didn't talk about it as much as I would like to, and that's the ego versus the soul-driven life. The ego-driven life versus the soul-driven life. And as I said, we've alluded to this in the past, but we've never functioned primarily on the ego. It's benefits and downsides, and we're also going to focus on what it means to live a soul-driven life, which is, you want to talk about nebulous and non-scientific. There you go on that. I want to start with a quote by Vaclav Havel, who is, I'm sure you know, is a brilliant writer, was a public dissident that really changed the Czech Republic and was actually the first president of the Czech Republic. And he wrote, Havel wrote the following: "Pride is precisely what will lead the world to hell." I'd like to repeat that because I think that's really powerful. "Pride is precisely what will lead the world to hell. I am suggesting an alternative: humbly accepting our responsibility for the world." That we have a personal responsibility for the world. He goes on and he says, "Our conscience must catch up to our reason, otherwise we are lost. It is my profound belief that there is only one way to achieve this. We must divest ourselves of our egocentrism and reestablish our respect for other people, for other nations, and for other cultures. And this can only grow from a humble respect of life." I like that quote really a lot. I think that when we get out of egocentrism and establish a respect for other people, other nations, other cultures, we can only see great benefit. And I think, you know, I swear I never get political, but our current president is not exactly in that realm. As a matter of fact, I'm not afraid to talk about him as a narcissist, which I think you know, his picture is in the dictionary when you want to talk about the term.
You're not going to get any pushback from me on that.
No, I'm not. And you know what? You may be a little soft.
Too soft? All right, how about that?
Okay, that's good.
That's good.
Right. Havel uses the phrase egocentrism, which leads me to the subject of ego. And we're going to begin, before we talk about a soul-driven life, we're going to talk about an ego-driven life. And I want to begin with the dictionary definition of ego, rather than trying to go to Freud and get the id and the ego and the superego. Just go, what is a simple definition of ego? And Webster, I think, really helps us when he calls ego a person's sense of self-esteem and self-importance. Ego is quite simply a person's sense of self-esteem and self-importance. And I thought about it, but I just decided not to get into the Freudian ideas of id, ego, and superego, which I on a very, very low level do kind of comprehend, kind of in a way, maybe. That's why I'm not going to talk about it, because there are plenty of Freudians out there that, you know, I don't want to see my comment box telling me that I have no idea what I'm talking about, which I probably don't when it comes to Freud. But in life in general, the ego is oddly both necessary and dangerous. It is necessary for meaningful impact. We must have a good ego, a strong ego. You know, a weak ego a weak ego actually, ironically, is what leads to narcissism. It's what leads a person. I know there was a friend of mine that was going to write a book one time, and I've always loved the title. He decided not to write the book. I asked him at the time when I was writing, can I have the title? And he says, absolutely, take it and run with it. But I don't write books anymore. Well, not now at least. But the title of the book was The High Value of Low Self-Esteem.
High Value of Low Self-Esteem.
Isn't
right.
that a great title?
It is.
That's a great title, The High Value of Low Self-Esteem. And what his theory was is that highly successful people very frequently have very low self-esteem, and they're trying to build their self-esteem through their achievements and through their accomplishments. Mm-hmm. And so they are extremely successful, extremely competent, and yet it's not working on the areas of self-esteem, so they keep getting stronger and stronger in what they're accomplishing, but weaker and weaker. It's like, you know, the square hole in the round peg, or vice versa. And so
I think there's truth to that. It's like the nerds that were beat up in school work hard to become the Bill Gates of the future. You know, I always found that the big successful kids in high school weren't the big successful kids in life.
You know, that's really funny. We were talking just off air. We were talking about Joe Rogan and Jordan Peterson interviewing right. Joe Rogan. And Joe Rogan, who is, you know, now a, you know, black belt in Taekwondo and in Jiu-Jitsu, and he's a world champion in Taekwondo, and he did this all in high school.
And one of the largest podcasters, if not the largest podcaster on the planet.
I think it's the largest. I think they talked about getting 3 million downloads a month.
Whew.
You know, that's a
big number.
That's 1% of the United States.
That's almost as much as you get.
Yeah, in like six lifetimes. but Joe is a small guy, you know, short, and you know, and he right. and he talks about that and uses that in his comedy, and I doubt that he's 5'6". And so he was criticized and bullied in high school quite a bit, and then he started with the Taekwondo, and it said it was funny. Nobody ever tried to fight him, but once they found out he was a black belt in Taekwondo, no one ever messed with him.
Exactly.
But that was what drove him, and he went to the gym, went to the whatever they call it. It's not a gym, but what do they call that?
I don't know.
Sean
Training Center?
No. Anyway, but he went. He worked out every day in Taekwondo, and it came from this lack of confidence, and it came from being bullied, and it came from the negative side that turned him where he could get a lot of self-confidence. And so,
I think negative feedback pushes many people farther than positive feedback does. I'm going to pro-show them. I'm going to overcome, and I'll show you.
Yeah, there is the I'll show you motif, which is really kind of actually kind of dangerous. But let's officially, we say we're officially on now. We're going to go ego-driven and soul-driven life, and.
What, define what that is. I don't know what a soul... It sounds sexy. It sounds appealing. What is a soul-driven life? I know an ego. All about me. What's a soul-driven life?
You know, that is an excellent question, Paul. And if I could answer it, I would.
Oh, okay.
Right. No, it's something... I do plan to address that, but if you don't mind, I'd like to address that toward the bottom of the show.
All right.
Because I want to deal with ego first, and then we'll deal with the soul second. But the soul, I mean, just to briefly answer, is more about intuition and the unconscious, and it's about dealing with, you know, I'm giving this all away, but we'll talk about it later, with like unselfishness and modesty and down-to-earthness and humility and altruism. Those are sort of soul driven
okay. Just so I know kind of what we're... One's about me, one's about others.
Exactly.
Right.
One's about me, one's about others. And also the soul-driven life could not only be just about others, it could be with the planet, with other nations, other people, and with
something
how we
more
take
than
care
yourself,
of the planet.
Right.
Yes.
Bigger reason other than just you.
Yeah, you are, you know, we call ourselves, we think life is all about me, and then I always like to remind people, well, everywhere you go, guess who's there?
You
are. So how do you not think life is not about you?
Right.
When it's so much. But so it takes a distinct effort to move away from that.
But we think of ourselves as early men did. We're the center of the, just like the Earth is the center of the universe. We thought we're the center of our own universe. And it takes something to bring you out of it and say, no, there's people around me. There's bigger issues than just mine.
Yeah, and that's a great question, you know, that we think we are the center of the universe. Are we indeed the center of our universe? I like to make it, personalize it, rather than the universe, you know, or the world. I have my world and my universe, and am I the center of that? You know, because like I said earlier in the little jest, you know, wherever I am, wherever I go, I'm there. And it's easy to begin to make it about me until I get to the point where I start making it about others. But let's do some dissecting of ego. And I've got three areas of ego that I want to talk about that I think will help us understand how we all fall prey to ego, and I really want to emphasize that I am not talking in general that ego is a bad thing. Ego is something we need, and we're going to talk about confidence and self-doubt, and you don't have confidence unless you do have some sort of self-respect and some sort of self-esteem. You just are not going to have the confidence you need.
So there's a healthy degree of ego.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that was what we talked about in the first and second half of life, the first half of life being a very sort of ego-centered life, and that was important to develop ourselves and fully develop who we are until we now own who we are, comfortable who we are, and we can move on to something else. We don't have to just be taking care of our needs, which is a very American sort of goal anyway.
Not to get too deep into psychology that I know even less about than you claim to, but Maslow's hierarchy is brought up here all the time by different business people, where you initially just start off seeking your basic needs to eat and survive. It's hard to be altruistic when you can't figure out how
exactly
where you sleep tonight,
exactly,
what you're going to eat. But later, when those needs are satisfied, then you can move up and start thinking of others in the world and whatnot.
But what happens is so many don't move beyond the phase one.
Right.
And because the needs increase, as you can never not spend all the money you make.
Yeah, right.
You know what? Right. You know, you think if I only had this $20,000 raise, well, the next year you spent it and you want another $20,000 raise.
And I always wonder what it's like, just to get off on a quick aside, what it's like to be a billionaire. A billionaire. If you had $1 billion, somebody proved to me once, you couldn't spend it all. You go buy $1 million house and $1 million yacht and a multi-$1 million this. You still, even with interest coming in on it, you can't spend it. So what does that do to your life? You cannot spend all the money you've made, ever. Does that instantly move you to an altruistic phase, or does that just sort of mess with you? You just try and get bigger and bigger,
you know,
toys.
You know, I've not studied those people. I've not studied billionaires or read enough about billionaires to know how altruistic they are. I know there are several, but I know there are several that are not.
Mm-hmm. That was the complaint against Bill Gates and several tech people for a long time. They were so focused on just building company bigger and bigger and bigger till they're all around the 100 million mark. And then suddenly they woke up and said, okay, maybe it's time to do something for somebody other than me here. But I just find that an interesting question, because we've never had that kind of wealth accumulation before, and it's only going to get bigger. So as you said, the assumption is once your needs are met, you're going to automatically become altruistic or open your mind. Maybe not so.
No. That's a heart change. That's a soul change. That's a I'm looking at life differently than I've ever looked at life before, and that is moving up Maslow's chart to where you hit the top of the chart, which is enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And enlightenment is a total loss of the ego, where I am almost nothing and not important at all, and what service I provide and how I view life becomes much more important. And since I'm certainly not reached enlightenment, I can't speak on that on detail.
So you go from an obsession with self to selfless, not without self, but less about you and more about something else.
Exactly. Good way to put it. Let's talk about these three manifestations of ego. And I think each one is distinct, and I think it will help us really understand ego a little bit more comprehensively and more than just about narcissism. And the three are that I've identified are egotism, egoism, and egocentrism. They may sound like they're the same thing, but they are quite distinct. And I want to begin with egotism. And egotism is the drive to maintain and enhance a favorable view of oneself. It's this one, I think, is the one we could spend probably more time on, because I think it's the most difficult, because we do need a good self-image.
Right.
In order for us to succeed in life, I mean, you talk about people interviewing for jobs. Confidence is one of the top things on the list. I had a young man calling me and asking me information about a subject, and he was a grad from an Ivy League school, and he exuded no confidence and did not come up with an agenda to talk to me about and have himself prepared. And you know, we had a 10-minute conversation. That was it. And it had a lot to do with, I think it had a lot to do with, it was where I really noticed a sense of lack of confidence. And I had a lot to do, and ordinarily I'd work with someone like that, but I elected not to.
So humbleness is not lack of confidence in yourself, or not projecting confidence into yourself. You know, when I grew up, your son's an athlete, we talk about all the time. The traditional successful big athletes, Johnny Unitas or Bart Starr or any of these baseball players, whatever they were in real life, their public life.
They were actually football.
Yeah, well, okay. But I'm just saying that all these guys, whatever, you know. But I'm saying these guys that were famous athletes, they were expected to be humble in public. They were not supposed to brag. They were not supposed to toot their own horn. They were supposed to downplay everything they did. Yeah, we played a pretty good game today. Pretty good game. You won by a million points here. Well, yeah, it was pretty good, but it's my team. And it was all about that suppression. We did not like to see. And those that did have egos got knocked down pretty quickly. Nowadays, my impression is that's switched. It's all about me. And some of that is about getting the big contract for the next round, and some of that is just unleashed egotism. I don't know.
Well, since I do have an in with professional baseball,
right,
the players on the team that are ego-centered, that are not team-centered, are really become outliers on the team. They are not popular people on the team. The team is looking for team guys that, you know, no matter what their position, whether they're starting, they're not starting, whatever it is, that they are team first. And even we have a guy, even, you know, I'm reticent to use his name, but yeah, I only have positive things to say about him. And we got a guy named Manny Machado, and a lot of people really had bad things to say about Manny Machado, that he was not a team player, that he was just only interested in himself and in his statistics, and that's just been proven absolutely wrong. My son says he's one of his favorite teammates. He's just a great guy in the clubhouse. He's a spark fire. Is that what you call him? Spark plug.
Spark plug.
Spark plug. There we go. He's a spark plug, and he's really encouraging. And my son, they do batting practice together, and so that's an opinion. I mean, that's an observation of a guy who is a superstar. I mean, this guy's making $300 million.
Wow.
He makes $30 million a year.
Wow. Let me give you a slightly different example. It's a business station, do lots of business shows, and it goes to your thing. Many people come in and say, in today's corporate world, don't wait for them to see what you're doing. You got to toot your own horn. You got to constantly be self-promoting yourself within the organization. That sounds rather ego-driven after a while. It's all about you. But they claim otherwise, you're going to get overlooked, and you're not going to get picked for the next
job. And that's absolutely, you know, I've advocated that for 2 decades with people that I've coached, that don't assume that your bosses are going to notice what you've done. You need to do it, and you can do it in performance reviews. You can do it subtly without being
obnoxious.
Obnoxious and a supreme egotist. Mm-hmm. That you can do that. And let's go on to this egotism. And you know, as I've indicated, we require to have a good self-image, but when it morphs into a total self-centeredness, then it becomes very problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And the total self-interest is what we would in one way, it could be a narcissist, but I've defined a narcissist in another one of them. But it is about people that only care that they are right. Their opinion is right, their ideas are right, and that they cannot be wrong. As a matter of fact, people with this, and it is a disorder, people with this disorder, if they find out they're wrong, they can actually go through sort of a mental crisis.
Hmm.
Because
how can that be? Yeah, how can I be wrong? So I'm still struggling. What's the difference between egotism, which seems to have some positive values to it, a strong self-confidence, and egoism? You define those as different.
Egoism, yeah, let's go ahead and go into that. Egoism is more about it's the ethical theory that treats self-interest as a foundation of morality.
Mm.
That's what egoism is. And so it's a philosophical term, and it talks about your value system, and that your value system of right and wrong and morality is based on what's best for you. Mm. That it is, so I can adopt my mentality or my morality to whatever serves my interest. See, that's quite different than egoism.
Yeah, right. Which, no, just so I'm not confused here. Ego, the first one you're talking about, a healthy self-confidence would be what?
A healthy self-confidence would be egoism, but on the healthy side of it, because egoism has both sides.
Okay.
It has the negative side.
It can go too far.
Yeah, it can go too far to where I then become so focused on myself that me and what happens to me and how I'm treated all is the most significant thing or most important thing in my life.
It's all I want to talk about. It's all I think about. Me, me, me. It's all about me.
I had a very close relative that is no longer alive, but he was an extreme I called it narcissist. I keep using this term that I want to use later. But you could not have a conversation with him without it being about him. You would come up and talk about something. I'd talk about something about my son, or I'd talk about something about my wife or in our life. And in no time, he would say, that reminds me of the time that I did so-and-so. And so the whole conversation would always be only about him.
Kind of like the old joke, somebody walks up and says, well, enough of me talking about myself. Why don't you talk about me? Same idea. So it's all about me, but ego.
I can't believe that you actually told that.
But egotism, the next one you want to go to, that's a worldview based on what's good for you. That's a philosophy, not just a personality quirk.
Yeah, can you repeat that for me one time? I was reading. I'm
okay.
Sorry.
All right, it's all about you, so we'll keep this straight. No, I said that the egoism is, as I understand it, if I'm getting this right, you're what you want to focus on. Me, me, me. And you can...
Yes. And your worldview is that way.
Right.
That all morality is based around your self-interest.
But then what does egotism become? Egotism's more of what I thought that second part, the philosophy of...
No, it's your actions. It's your actions and what you believe about yourself. It's not moral value where you're judging the morality, the moral context of the world around you. It's only talking about yourself.
Okay, so give me a quick summary. But egoism is focused on you. Egotism is what?
Egoism is a practical, everyday, down to earth, the way we act.
Right.
Egotism is more of a philosophy.
Oh, I see. So egotism, that's right. Because he's an egotist. Egotism's about me. Egoism is more of a philosophy about world centers around me. Then.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, does that help?
It. Yeah. So I'm
okay.
I think we're bouncing back and forth. And my head was spinning here.
Oh.
And this show's about me and getting my answers correct. So I want to make sure it's no.
Well, if your head was spinning, you're not the only one. My head was spinning just a little bit there too.
I like it. Egotism. He's an egotist about you. Egoism. Now we're getting into more of a philosophy.
Right. Right.
And what is that philosophy?
And that philosophy is, I'm all that counts.
So I don't care what happens to other people. I only care what happens to me.
You know, I don't think, you know, Paul, I don't think, you know, it'd be easy to say that, but I don't think it goes that far where people would actually say, I don't care what happens to others, but their actions and the way they've identified or created their lifestyle, their approach to life, the way they deal with other people, is really very self-centered. And it's like, you know, the relative I was talking about who was totally incapable of talking about other people and learning about other people because he was so interested in himself.
So are they without sympathy? They can't feel for others? Are they without empathy? They can't... I guess empathy is feeling for somebody. Sympathy is feeling sorry.
Okay.
Are they without those characteristics?
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to have to play shrink here, which I am reluctant to do because I'm not a shrink, but I often say I've been shrunk so much that I'm, you know, I'm dangerously shrinkage. That it is what makes somebody egocentric is the lack of those two words that we had in Merriam-Webster, self-esteem and self-importance.
Okay.
When we don't have those, then we are, you know, the old seeking for love in the wrong places, we're seeking for ego.
We're seeking.
In the wrong places. We're seeking for self-approval, self-confidence.
Look at me because nobody ever did, I think. Or pay attention to me because I don't feel important. Make me feel important.
Yeah, and the difficulty with that is it really is promoted in our society.
Oh, big time. It's all about look at me. Can I give you just an interesting aside? We had a show a couple of years ago. A bunch of young girls would come in and talk about the challenge of motherhood today and how they weren't ready for it. Okay, interesting topic. One of the girls they brought in was very attractive. All tattooed up, though, and, you know, really exotic. And she'd had a lot of breast implants and lip implants and everything. The embodiment of what everybody thinks is a Playboy bunny kind of look today. And they were always talking about, oh, you're easy. You've had kids and you still look like this. We have kids and our bodies have changed. And she said at one point, a very honest thing, she said, the only reason I do all this is just so somebody will look at me, because my whole life nobody's ever looked at me. So I'm screaming out in all that I do, here, look at me. She's altered her body just so people will pay attention to her because she feels deep down nobody really cares or pays attention to her. I thought, wow.
Yeah, that's a sign of lack of love too. That she doesn't have that aspect of her life.
That's, to that extreme physically.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. But so we talk about egotism, egoism, and then the last one is, if you thought the first two were confusing, the last one is even more confusing, is egocentrism. And that is, this is really, maybe this is easier to define. The resource that I read called it the inability to differentiate between the self and the other. Is that it is gone, that's what I called narcissism. It has gone so far that I can't even recognize there is another.
And if there is another, they must be bad, because I'm great.
I don't know, Paul. I don't even know if they get to that point, if they get to thinking that everything is so much about me, and it is so much that I even view the other, what's happening with the other, I view that as part of me, as reflecting part of me. And so all of my thinking is only about me, and I even take other things that are occurring in my life, and I don't see other people's points of view, other people's behaviors, other people's issues or problems. I see only how it's affecting me.
Wow. Well, people know my political views. I'm not a fan of the current president, but I would say that describes many of his actions. His view of this constant railing against the others and his constant bragging about how he's the greatest, best, brightest, smartest, strongest, toughest guy in the world.
Yeah, a lot of politicians do that.
I've never seen going to the extent that he does. Everything is, I'm the greatest.
Yeah,
and the world, everybody else is bad. The other is bad.
Whether I agree or disagree, I'm not going to get into the politics of that.
Well, you opened the door in the beginning.
I opened the door in the beginning, but that
was
just
as far as the crack
that was
goes.
The beginning. That was it. So let's cement that. You know, let's
close the door.
Plaster again. Up that crack all that right. I that
so
I.
So who
did
would
that.
Give me an example of an egocentric person? We start off with an egotist. It's all about me. An egoism. The world revolves around me. An egocentric person somehow has gone further than that. I can't think of anything but me. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. Everything is. Not that I can't just think of anything but me. It's gone to where even things that are not me, that are just obviously not me, I take so personally that it does all become about me. It's like where we were talking about becoming about me earlier, this is like becoming about me on steroids.
I've seen people come up and you say, oh boy, something, Joe just did something, that's really terrible. And they take offense. And it's like, it's not about you. Why you're getting upset? I'm telling you this has happened over here and you're somehow trying to translate it into some other personal affront against you. It's not about you at all.
Well, isn't that what about 90% of our arguments are about?
Yeah, right, right.
They're about things that don't have anything to do with me, like my president.
Exactly, right. And yet we're getting into or my team or my neighbor or my sister just said this and did that, and I'm suddenly turning it into a very personal thing. She didn't do it to attack me. She's just a nasty person or whatever. I don't have a sister, but, you know, whatever it is.
You know, I was listening to a sort of soul enriching speaker, and that was, you know, he's sort of a mystic, and there's a definite spirituality to him, but it is not of any sort of religion that we have.
Okay.
And he was talking, and then I've heard several people talk about it since. That when we are governed by the ego and driven by the ego, that is a small self. We have a large self inside us that is a more accepting and embracing sort of side. Mm-hmm. And then we have that small self that is only all about me. And that is a side that we are constantly combating. And I have found that it doesn't occur in young age because you're still trying to figure out who you are. It occurs in older age at, 40, 50, 60. And I think it really hit me, although I was living a non-ego-centered life, I think I've lived a much more open life for the last decade than I ever have. And that's getting into, let's go, as we're about halfway through. Should we take a break or should we just go on?
Let's take a break and let everybody digest that a little bit, because you covered three very subtle differences, but very important differences between it's all about me to the world revolves around me to I can't think of anything but me. That's a progression of personality types that we see all, far too much of in today's world, I think.
Okay.
And I'd like to see if that is a symptom of modern society and if it's getting worse or if that's we're just noticing it more because they've got bigger mediums to broadcast with.
Okay.
So we'll come back right after this and we talk about all that on the next chapter.
Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and we are talking, producer Paul and I are talking about an ego-driven life versus a soul-driven life, and it's really interesting here, because I've had trouble making distinctions exactly on the ego, because the ego is so important, and it is important that I have self-esteem and that I have self-regard that gives me the
respect. Yeah,
yes,
right, yeah.
That gives me the confidence to even be doing this radio show.
Right.
If I didn't have it, I wouldn't be on. And yet, at the same time, if I'm only thinking about me, that would become obvious on the first show that we ever did.
Right. The listeners wouldn't listen.
Only thinking about me. Yet both of those are really important. And what I want to talk about now is the other side, because we're talking about an ego-driven life and a soul-driven life. And
right.
The ego-driven life is driven by what the mystics call the small self.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the needy self, the self that never seems to get satisfied. And that's because, and I think it's because it doesn't take the soul route. And I looked up words that would define soul that I mentioned earlier in the podcast, but words that would give us definition of what a soul-driven life would look like.
The first question I asked you, right, what is a soul-driven life?
Unselfishness, modesty, down-to-earthness, humility, altruism. See, none of that is about the self.
No,
none is about the self. All it is about is others and how I get along with others, and actually, I would even put in there how I accomplish my results. In there, if I'm at a job, am I looking only what's in it for me, and that I'm the actor, I'm the primary actor, as opposed to working well with a team and working unselfishly and collaboratively with a team.
Would it be fair to say that egoism, tism, and centric, all about ego, is a more narrower view of the world, and a soul is a wider view of the world?
Yeah, I think I would prefer the verb more limited.
Okay.
Than narrow. I think it limits us to only ourselves, and it doesn't limit us to the world, and it doesn't open up or give opportunity to the world. Great examples of that. The people that we look at that are the egoist of the world,
mm-hmm,
have been the Stalins and the Hitlers and Genghis Khan.
Right.
That was all about me and building my empire, and the people that we look at that are on the opposite term, on the opposite way of soul-driven, you know, I think of Gandhi and I think of
Mother Teresa.
Mother Teresa, of course. And
it's
about
them as opposed to all about me. But part of that, even with the extreme authoritarians that you said there, I could name a bunch of corporate executives that have that image too of you know, take no prisoners, tough guys. There is a certain appeal to that strength for many people. And it's just somehow it gets taken too far.
Yeah, I think, Paul, that might have been true with the baby boomers, but I don't think it's true with the millennials. I don't think the millennials take to that kind of leadership at all. That's what I'm hearing from corporate leaders, and we're going to have a millennial expert on the show that's going to talk more about that.
Because, and just again, I don't want to get political, but we seem to be going through a period of authoritarianism around the world where authoritarian figures are popping up, not just in Russia and China, but in Europe and other places around Turkey, the Philippines, all these macho, strongman leaders seem to be a popular model again. And I don't know what's causing that. If it's just, again, there's something appealing about that extreme egotist. Is it because they provide something you don't have within you? Gee, I'm not strong, but he is. I'm going to follow him or her.
You know, this person may portray more hope than another person because they are so self-absorbed and so believe in their doctrine or their motives or
their power
actions
to change something
that they convince other people that they are going to make things better for them.
Yeah, we seem to look for supermen. We look for superheroes. We're not. There are periods of time when we're turned off by that, but right now we seem to be one searching for it. Maybe it is because people feel hopeless.
Yeah, this next election will be very interesting to see.
I think so. It'll determine which direction we're going in. So I guess my question before you go too much further in the soul stuff is this a symptom, you've said it in the past, of a Western society on steroids? Is this the same in third world countries that you see where it's all about, certainly they have dictators and whatnot, but it's, you say that what people in villages in Africa live differently than our village here in Irvine.
Well, I think the village in Africa, if you're talking on a village level, they are absolutely dependent on corporate living. Mm-hmm. They're dependent on one another, helping one another do different tasks,
right.
Do farming, building, working together.
They can't survive without each other.
Yeah, it really is a matter of survival. But if you talk the leadership in third world countries, it's extremely, extremely ego-driven, and it's all about me.
Their pictures are all over every wall. And
the president of Uganda, one of the poorest countries in the world, is the fourth richest president in Africa. He's worth $3.5
billion. Wow.
And his country is just going to hell. But that's not just Uganda. I mean, that's Nigeria,
the
Congo, that's probably 80% of Africa.
So it's an interesting dichotomy. The people on a small level, small scale, do think about each other and do rely on each other. But the people who take control of the society as a whole are those who don't exhibit those qualities. It's all about me and how much I can congregate and coalesce around me, money, power, strength.
Well, as we're talking, it's making me think that they are much more primordial and that they are much more tribal and communal, mm-hmm. because this is what it requires for survival.
Right.
You cannot survive on your own.
And clearly in Irvine, I can survive on my own. I mean,
and, well, the whole United States is that way. I mean, now we have millions that cannot survive on their own.
Right.
But the ethos of the country is individualism and is freedom.
Right.
And both of those are, individualism is all about me.
Right.
And freedom is about choices that make me better.
Right.
What I'm advocating is this soul side, which I think we pay, you know, I like it. It's not quite as clear, but once you get it, it's very understandable, and it's much more intuitive that you are listening to your intuition or to what Carl Jung would call your unconscious.
The collective unconscious, right?
Well, there is a collective that's different than the personal unconscious. But I believe we have windows to our soul, and then we have windows to our unconscious. And they're usually at very difficult times in our life. But if we pay attention to that and listen to that, it matures us. It takes us to another level. It takes us to understanding that problems with me or that happen to me are just a natural part of the way the world is built.
And yet our society, since the beginning of mechanization and industrialization, seems to turn out more and more soulless people, people who are just part of the system, people who don't see themselves as special or individuals, or who are just act like they're brain dead. They're tuned out, they're turned off, all the stuff we've talked about before, apathetic and don't care and don't try to care.
Yeah, I hate making judgments on people, but I feel much of what you're saying is right. I had a public speaker who once and I listened to quite a bit, and he was he used this phrase quite commonly, which I always loved. He says, 5% of the people think, 15% of the people think they think, and 80% of the people would rather die than think.
I like that. I'm going to use that again. 5% really are thinking, 15% think they're thinking, and the rest of the world would die rather than think. I love that, because I know so many people in all three of those categories.
Well, but what he does is he translates it into three usable concepts. First, he says the 5% are your creators. Mm-hmm. There's only 5% of truly creative people that are making something that has not been made before, or doing things in a way that has not been done before.
Yeah, I'd buy that, whether it's in business or sports or art or whatever.
Right. And the second 15% are adapters. Mm. That they will take what the creatives have created, and they will adapt it and make it work for them or for something else.
Yeah.
But they didn't come up with the creation, and I think they're probably the geniuses of the world that have really succeeded, because very few times do creators make any money or have any success.
Steve Jobs, many would argue, was not he needed the Steve Wozniaks, the people to actually make the code and make the machine work. His genius was taking it and adapting it, selling it to people for uses they hadn't thought of before.
I had once read in Wired magazine, and this was like 20 years ago, is that the first adapters are always the most successful in any business. Hmm. You know, the creator that came up with the business, mm-hmm. it's the first adapter that was able to model that, because they, you know, the creator, just by nature, you take a look at the creator, you know, they're not always the marketer,
no.
The person to, or the strategic person, or the business person. They have a creative idea, but the adapters have all of those other people that are there now.
Just as Tesla, the famous inventor, would died penniless because he didn't know what to do with what he was doing, and he worked for it. It was either Westinghouse or Edison or both. I forgot which one he worked for, and they took his ideas and took him to other levels.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I tried to go look up the exact story of Tesla, but it was something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and his name was Tesla,
yeah,
right?
Nikola Tesla.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was a genius. You go look up, came up with all sorts of ideas that became common in electricity and whatnot.
Yeah, it's a perfect example.
He did not take it and become, before he died, penniless. And it was either Westinghouse or Edison that he worked for. I forgot which one. And they took his genius and translated it into something that, as first adopters, that made them fortunes and famous.
First adapters.
Adapter, I mean, yeah.
First, right. Because that leads us to our third people, the group of people, the 80% of the people that would rather die than think. Mm-hmm. He called those adopters.
Adopters, right. They just simply follow and do what...
Just tell me what to do. I don't want to have to think about it. I don't have time for this. Mm-hmm. I have plenty on my schedule. I've got my kids. I've got sports. I've got my jobs. I've got my spouses. I've got my gyms. Mm-hmm. and all of this. I don't want to have to think through this how I'm going to do it. Just give me a plan and give me the ideas, and I'll make that happen.
I hate to say it, but I think that's my daughter, and I think she'd be the first to admit it. She'd just much rather tell me what to do. I don't have the time or interest to think about it too much, whether it's at work or in so many things. I'm not saying that sounds a negative thing when I say it, because I guess I view those people in a negative light. I try to think of myself as one of the first two groups, but I think most of the world is not, just for all the reasons you said. Not interested, just tell me what to do, and I'll do it.
And it really works. That works, oddly enough, you think that would work in a socialist state, that is...
Right, top I down, mean, right.
That really is the ethos of a socialist state, but it also works really well in capitalism. It really works well in our marketing, and if we're adopters, we're not trying to compete, we're not trying to
change it.
We're just saying,
it, yeah,
you know, give me that little device that pushes the can forward in the Smart Mart, and you know, I get my monster drink, and another one fills, and you know, I don't have to think about anything.
Pretty cool. I'm happy with that till you come up with another one.
But I think this is the soul-driven people are the ones that are reaching, that are going higher and higher on Maslow's chart, and I really think this is where intuition. I'm a strong believer in intuition, that I believe intuition is always fed by reason and data. That I have reason and data that are rumbling around in some witch's brew in my unconscious that will come to light without me even realizing that I've brought something new into light. I think that whenever I am creative or in a strong adaptive mode, that is what's coming to effect. It is not my rational side.
Because that's not what most people would think of. They think of it more as revelation than inspiration is revelation from some other source other than yourself, God or some divine spirit or the God speaking in your ear. But you're saying that it's that revelation springs from within you somewhere. There's something.
Absolutely.
Growing.
Yeah, I am. I so strongly believe that.
It's not external, it's internal.
Yes, and it's listening to us internally. I mean, you know the old talk that's, you know, it's debatable in science, but, you know, it comes out that we only use 10% of our brain.
Right.
Well, 90% of our brain is thinking so fast, and there is so much information going on and so many things that are happening that we have to... I think it's really important. That's why I'm a big advocate of... That's going to sound silly, but I'm a major advocate of thinking. I wrote a blog on it the other day. When was the last time?
You think a lot about thinking.
I do. I do. And it's, when was the last time you sat down for 15 minutes to an hour in a chair and did nothing but think?
Doesn't make good radio.
It doesn't make good radio, but to think and just whatever comes to your mind, and that's giving your unconscious, that's giving your soul permission to come alive.
You've explained something in my own life that maybe I've never been able to explain. Most people say I'm a creative person. That's just, and I like to see myself that way. Whether I am or not, I think of myself that way. That's my ego. I find, and my wife will always say, you're so creative, I can't come up with stuff like you do. And I say, everybody can. I really think there's creativity in all of us, but somewhere along the way it gets locked out or lost. Maybe some have more of it, but there is creativity. And I find myself, she says, I don't know how to do it. I find myself to be most creative in those twilight moments when I'm half awake and half asleep, when I'm laying in the hammock in the backyard, when I first wake up in the morning, when I'm just getting ready to go to bed and I get five thoughts and I got to jump up and write them down. Those are my most creative moments.
And I have read psychologically that is true. That in those, it's the moments between sleep and awareness, you know, in those twilight moments as you define them, that is when our creativity is at its top.
I've always felt that way. And so as somebody who's been identified as a creative person, that's when I found my creativity. And I wonder if we can if we can stimulate that by finding more of those 15-minute quiet periods of closing your eyes and somehow finding that in-between zone between conscious and unconscious.
That's funny. I knew a woman whose father invented the baby stroller.
Really?
Invented the baby stroller, and she said he had a dream. The whole thing, he saw the whole thing in a dream, and then just came out and drew it on paper and went to work
Paul McCartney do an interview from the Beatles once. I can't tell you which song it was, but it was one of the more famous ones. They said, how did you write it? He said, I woke up and I heard the whole thing.
Yeah. Oh, I believe that. Yeah, I believe that, especially with Paul McCartney. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, but that, it didn't, it, that idea that somehow it was just there and all I had to do was write it down before it disappeared.
I know there are times, that's why I always had, and I haven't for the last few years, which I rue, I always had either whiteboards or flip charts in my office, because an idea would just come to me, and I knew if I didn't write it down and didn't draw some kind of picture of it, that
it would be lost.
That I would just lose it, and some of my most creative ideas came from those flip charts.
My wife knows that when I'm on, if I'm at home and something strikes me and I got to go upstairs and start writing it down, don't disturb me till it's over, because if you break that moment, it's lost. It's like somebody's whispering it in my ear and I can only write it down so quickly, and eventually the voice, it's not like I hear voices, but whatever that is, I liken it to a voice, that inspiration, that thought, that idea drains over time.
Yeah, that's like our CEO at Wells of Life. I was on an airplane with him, and I have never sat with somebody that has so many, ideas.
He's definitely one of
I mean, he's got ideas. So I encouraged him to get a Moleskine, to get a Moleskine or whatever, however you pronounce
that
word.
Little fancy.
Yeah,
book.
and just write down your thoughts all the time. And he's just now he's just got a library of those little books. And
yeah. Well, have you ever seen Da Vinci's drawings? I've read where Da Vinci wrote like that, and they're just pages and pages, books and books and volumes of crazy things he came up, most of which didn't turn into anything, but crazy ideas, machines, things that he envisioned, some of which, like helicopters, did come to be true. But, you know, I think there's something to that. Just wherever that comes from, when you tap into that wellspring, that unconscious part of you that you're describing, get it out as much as you can, because there's genius in there.
Absolutely. I think you're bang on. I'm going to wrap us up.
Okay.
And I would like to repeat what we opened with in our quote from Vaclav Havel, where I think pride and ego are almost synonymous in this particular quote, and that pride is precisely what will lead the world to hell. I'm suggesting an alternative: humbly accept our responsibility for the world. That's the soul side. Mm-hmm. Our responsibility for the world is the soul side. The pride is the ego side. And I think it's time, the less we think of ourselves and the less we think of taking care of our own pleasures, and the more we think of taking care of other people, the better off we will be and the better off the planet will be.